So for the second speaker of the day, we have Marcus Obertaler from Heidelberg University, who will be talking to us about how a quantum field simulator can address quark, gluon plasma, and cosmology-inspired questions.
Well, super. Thank you very much. So, welcome. As you can see, it will be about experimental activities, and the title has no experiment in there. Quantum field simulators seem to be something very general. No? It's kind of an experiment, can be kind of, I don't know what, also on a computer. So I have to change a little bit the title and make it specific, and I will go about how ultra-cold gases can address questions. It's not analog or anything, but it can address certain parts of questions which are inspired by certain fields. And one is high-energy physics, quark gluon plasma, and we will not do quark gluon plasma. We do not kind of standard model. We have a certain sub-aspect of dynamics as quark gluon plasma studied we can address, okay? And that's why I'm not so happy with analog, because analog suggests too much, I think. And that's why I always use inspired. Yeah. And ultra-cold gases is what I use, and I also would like, yesterday was a discussion, what's the best system for, I don't know, thinking about gravity. And I think there's, in this kind of context, as I've explained it now, there is no best system. There are different systems with different strengths which allow you to attack different aspects of one physical system. And there are typically more than one aspect of a physical system, but there might be only few aspects of a mathematical model. And that's what we do. We try to implement experimentally mathematical models. And that's why my group is called quantum, synthetic quantum systems. Okay, so now let's come back to what I want to tell you. And actually, I have three topics, which I most likely will not do. The chairman said I don't get 2 hours. So I will squeeze it somehow, but I wanted to transport that. And actually, one of the things I'm really squeezed much is to the kind of level of inception. So I want to set a seed where you can maybe get an idea what these quantum field simulators can do in the future. Okay. So now let me come back to the original title. Why do I call ultra-cold gases something like quantum field simulators? And this is a little bit to put myself or my activities into a different perspective than it's usually done in our field. Our field is typically inspired by these kind of situations. You have condensed matter systems, and you want to simulate condensed matter systems, and obviously, condensed matter systems are systems with discrete structure in space. It's in a lattice. And that's why there are beautiful experiments on lattices where you can kind of get certain aspects of the physics here onto a system, it's actually very hard to see, what you can study in the system like this here. Okay, and that I call discrete quantum simulator. It's discrete in space, and it has objects which are single quantas moving on a lattice. Beautiful things you can do there. Now we know condensed matter is, and condensed matter systems are the end of a very long story. And the long story is you are the experts in. Long story is the history of the universe. And if you think about where are particles, well, they're obviously here, condensed matter systems are here, but if you go in this direction, you would think, well, maybe particles, although they are represented like particles here, is not the right way of thinking about it. You should rather think about fields and interaction and coupling between fields and their dynamics. So in that respect, the discrete space, actually, do you see the pointer?
You could use the hockey stick, Marcus.
Yeah, the hockey stick, but then I have to do it here.
Yeah.
Can you see the screen down there? Well enough? Oh, super. Then I did the hockey, because this is really cool. The hockey stick is a very important thing for playing games. It's also a very important thing to explain climate change. I don't know who knows the hockey curve, which actually the temperature over time, and actually diverges, or actually not diverge, but it goes up when people started to burn fuels. Okay, anyway, so this is another different topic. I have to come back to this kind of question here. We want to be in a regime where fields are the objects or the mathematical elements which describe our system well. Or vice versa, we produce a system where fields are a good description. But that this I still need. How about that? Okay, so now how do we do it? I mean, you have heard most likely have heard talks about these lattice systems. How can you get in a regime where fields? And fields means like in space, continuous. That's actually easy. You just do less than the others. You take away the lattice. So you have a gas which is continuous in space, and that's a kind of one step. The other step is that there's a field. A field is a number on space and time for me. And these are actually numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and not a continuous number like any kind of complex number. So how do we do that? And one way of getting continuous number is adding many discrete numbers up. So take many particles, and now you still see the particles. So I also will kind of reduce the system to one dimension. Now you have many particles in one dimension, but still you see the particles. But now you start doing a coarse graining of this system. You're saying, now I'm not interested in a particle. Actually, I cannot measure a particle, because each particle is anyway delocalized of the whole system. We start to kind of coarse grain the system. Now we kind of look at a certain volume, and in this volume, there are about maybe 100 particles, and these 100 particles are now described by a vector, maybe, not so badly, if each of the particles is a vector, say spin. So actually now you have a large spin, which is a sum of individual spins, but you detect only the large spin. Sounds like a big step back. But if you think about quantum field theory, that's actually cool, because now you have a field with such maybe 3 components, and you can look for dynamics of that. Now the question is, where is quantum here? Now quantum you can do by actually putting here hats mathematically. But experimentally, what it means is this vector is not pointing in one direction, it will fluctuate. So if you measure it from shot to shot or realization to realization, you will find the vector is not pointing in one direction, it has fluctuations. But this is very natural for any spin. If you have a spin in x direction, you get equally likely up or down. And if you have a large spin, well, okay, similar thing. So at the end of the day, if you want to do quantum field theory or quantum field questions addressing with your system, you rather should look not at the mean value of this vector, but rather to the fluctuations. Okay, now fluctuations by itself is one thing, but essentially you have an extended system. You're just looking at one space, gives you some information, but not what really describes the system and also what not are good questions. Much better is you look at 2 positions. And now we can ask, how are those 2 things correlated? Okay, now we have a 2-point correlator in fields that you can actually now extract experimentally because you can measure here and here in one realization. Then things is gone, the system is gone, and you start again. And with that, you build up enough realization that you can do good mean values of 2-point correlations, for example. And 3-point, 4-point, in this case, is then no question anymore because you have this information for each point. No, for each voxel. You have it for a finite volume. This is small. If the evolution of the field is large compared to this kind of small scale, then you can hope, actually, that the field is theoretical description of this field is a good approximation. Okay. But then you have all these kind of ingredients you would like to have theoretically. Namely, you can ask to characterize your system via correlation functions. It's one of the most natural things to do in this kind of situation. And that's what I call quantum field setting. Okay. So now, the question is, if you look at this, and you say this is a field, and you start from atomic physics, you would say, this is maybe a field, but there is a fundamental field. The fundamental field are the atoms. They have different magnetic substates. They have 3 fundamental fields describing your system. And it is true, but on this level of the fundamental fields, describing the physics is extremely complicated. It's much better to go in the regime of composite fields, adding up these fields to new fields and do for them an effective kind of theory, trying to find an effective theory describing the system. Okay? Now the question is, you can do this nicely plotting it and say this is what you can do, but at the end of the day, if you have a simulator has 3 steps, right? You have an input, you have some processing, and then comes one part, which is the output. So you have to ask, what can you measure experimentally? What can you access? Okay, so now I told you the kind of fundamental fields we can address easily. It's just a Stern-Gerlach, we measure how many particles are in what state, okay? We can also measure coherence, for example. But we are interested now in the spin. What? Ah. Okay, so these are the fundamental fields, and you can measure this with Stern-Gerlach, for example. But you can do it also differently and a little bit smarter. You actually take your Hilbert space where the physics runs, and before you do the detection, you expand your Hilbert space, you connect them via unitaries, and then read out not three numbers, but eight numbers. This you can do with atoms because they have internal structure. I'm not going into these details. But at the end of the day have, you have at each point eight numbers. Okay, and these eight numbers you can now, depend on what unitaries you do here, give you some information what was here. Now this is spin one. Spin one has eight generators, and it turns out you can measure all of them, always two of them, or sometimes three of these generators. So you ask, I want to see the quadruple operator expectation value and do a spatial correlation, we can do it. It's just like a question of how you do the manipulation here in with this microwave and RF coupling. So one example is you make a spin wave, and a spin wave which is a spin which rotates like this. Can you detect this? Well, if you do a projection, you would get, well, the component in the up direction is maximum, zero, minimum, well, maximum again because absolute value, and so on. But you don't see the angle. Suppose it's not a wave like this, but a wave like tilted like this. So you have now all three dimensions of this spin exploring. And if you do this with the readout here, and that's what we call positive operator valued measure readout, then essentially you have eight numbers per position. And remember, this is a voxel. Each voxel has about 100 particles. You can read out Sx, Sy, and Sz for one realization. Okay? And it's a big thing, because now a quantum field simulator is kind of given. You have the input, that's under very good control. You have evolution, which might be an effective equation, we don't know. Or, you, yeah, just a moment, let me finish the sentence. You have a system where you have the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian you want to implement, and then you detect at the end the field. Yeah, Silke.
You said a voxel is 100 particles. Sorry, what is that?
A voxel is the pixel in three dimensions. It's a voxel. And so it's a volume. NMR, they use voxels because of volume. And in this volume, you have about 300 particles. What this means is, if you do a measurement, and you have n spins pointing in the same direction, you get an answer. Namely, the expectation value is well-defined already with 100 particles. Is that explaining? Okay, very good. So, what can we do? Well, you have this picture here, and I will come back to this picture. And the first part now I would like to show you is how you can somehow connect to quark-gluon plasma. So what's quark-gluon plasma? And I'm not an extreme expert in that, but it's connected to experiments at CERN where they do little banks. So this mesh, kind of nuclear, like nuclear particles, like lead, for example. You smash them with high energy on top of each other, and then what you get is in the overlapping region after the collision, you get an energy density. You get as many particles as antiparticles. Actually, it's in a regime where mainly it's all dominated by gluons, and then this kind of fluctuating initial state develops in time. And then actually, you get hadronization, i.e. you form real particles, and then you get the kinetic readouts, i.e. the motion is gone, and then later on you detect it. Now this whole thing here lasts, from here to here is 10 to the minus 22 seconds. And when do you detect the whole thing? Is, well, you go about 15 orders of magnitude later, you look what comes out of this collision. And you look at the particles, their momentum, and their energy. And now the name of the game is, what can you learn out of these measurements about what's going on here? It's amazing what you can say. It's like a hydrodynamic flow, the perfect fluid, amazing. Now, how does this connect to our original question of fields? We are now in this regime of about 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 6 seconds. Okay? Good. So now this is what you want to study, this quark-gluon plasma, which is in there. It's expanding, cooling down, and essentially lots of things happen there. It's a very complicated situation. And this is complicated, it's not for me. So I have to do something simple because I want to have a model system implemented, and that seems to be maybe the reality. At least it's our picture what might happen there. So where we are going to now is not where you have hadronization, which is extremely hard, to have this kind of confinement physics implemented in our systems, but what we can go is in a regime where the system is relatively well described by some bosonic fields, say 8. 8 is also hard for us, we can do 3, but if you do 3 bosonic fields, it's almost a large number, and that actually the situation is at the very beginning here. At the beginning, you have many kind of 8, well, the gluon field is actually what is dominating there. And then I thought, naively as I am, I thought, oh, these quantum field theory people did do the real standard model calculation and ask what happens if you start here and go to there. But actually, it's not true. This early phase, which is also called plasma, so gluon plasma, gluons are dominating, actually is also described theoretically with a model, because certain models have certain solutions, maybe even analytic solutions. So what's the model describing this initial state here? And the state is actually not what you can tackle, but you can start with saying, I have a state with strong fluctuations, high occupation numbers with a certain length scale. The length scale is produced by this kind of structure of this nuclei you collide. And then you ask what happens. And what's the model? The model is an O(n) model. Okay, people told me n equals 3 is already infinity. In that respect, our 3 bosonic fields are not so bad, maybe. And this actually was Jürgen Berges who looked into this situation. Actually, it's an O(n) model, so n interacting, for me, fields all equally interacting. You can do analytic calculations. And what he was looking for was, what kind of dynamics can you expect in this regime where you have high occupation numbers? And he writes down this equation, and I don't understand this equation, but I can show it because I know certain things. I know that this is connected to the two-point correlation function, and I know that this one is a one-particle irreducible four-vertex, which connects the different fields. Okay? So that sounds like the fields, the dynamics is given by the fields interact, and thus the two-point correlation change in time. That these kind of four vertices itself themselves have a time dependence is in a peculiar situation, and actually will lead to a very special phenomenon, namely a non-sum of fixed point dynamics in this system. You have to integrate all these vertices and things like this. Experimentally, we do the experiment, and whatever you have to sum, we don't do, we just look what we get out. So, and that will be two levels now for the following discussion. One level would be, can we somehow get a hold on what kind of structure mathematically is in our system? Or the other level is, this kind of equation predicts that there is a universal time dynamics regime where the dynamics become simple, although you have a very complicated, strongly fluctuating situation. I will start with the first part. So the narrative, all these equations boil down to a trinity graph. It's not holy, but it's a trinity graph. It has three kind of points. And who knows the movie Matrix, there's also Trinity there, and there's a blue bill and a red bill. And the blue bill is you stay where you are, you don't know what happens behind the curtain. And the red bill is where you find out actually you are just part of a big program. Okay, so we go for the interesting part, namely the non-summal fixed point. And this is kind of a representation of what's going on, but it's not kind of that this fixed point is kind of defined, it's there. It just says that if you get, it's a narrative, if you get close to this kind of situation where the fixed point is dominating the physics, things become as simple as a critical point. Namely, you get critical exponents, and that's actually describing a very complicated situation. It doesn't have to be like this, but in this quark gluon plasma O(n) model with strong occupation number at the beginning, this happens. Okay, so now how do we describe this kind of universality? What are the features of it? This is now more kind of what phenomenology is there? Can we see this experimentally? So I told you the two-point correlator is the object we are interested in. And the two-point correlator depends, because especially symmetric, like a translation is invariant, then it depends only on the differences between the two points. And then if you have differences between two points, you can ask about length scale. And then typical thing, what you plot is inverse length scale and the Fourier transform of this kind of two-point correlation function. That's what you show here. You plot it log-log, and then you have the power spectrum. That's now a language question, but the power spectrum. And you see, like, for a beginning time, you might get an evolution where you have a flat top here at the beginning at low k, with Matt yesterday evening, we had a very interesting discussion where he found this was very extremely interesting, that this dynamically emerges. And Silke was there inspiring us into the discussion. And then you have a drop-off with a certain power law for larger k. And the prediction of this non-thermal fixed point of this dynamics is that this kind of structure factor does not change in shape. Okay? So you can describe this whole dynamics, which might be very complicated in rescattering of particles and fields. You can describe it as a universal function. And then you have a rescaling of the argument in time and the amplitude in time. After a certain time, you have to find the time. And only after this time, it depends relative to this time. And then you can choose any time afterwards. You would be able to describe the dynamics with a function and two numbers. That's the kind of non-thermal fixed point, how it would show up in the experiment. So now how do we do this experimentally? This is now comes the initial state. Simulation runs like initial state definition. You let the evolution go, and then we measure. Okay, initial state is we cannot do a big bang nor a small bang, but we can do a quantum bang. And the quantum bang is we start in a phase where we can prepare the ground state very well, and then we change the Hamiltonian of our system such that we get to a different phase. This phase is a very interesting one. It's the easy plane ferromagnetic phase. And we start with no magnetization and go to the easy plane ferromagnetic phase. What should happen? But for long times, you should build up this kind of expected ground state properties, which you would then represent as a solution or like a free energy consequence that you're be down here and that's your ground state. Actually, it's not, you don't know what phase you are, so experimentally you will have the observation that you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. But that would be the final picture in thermal equilibrium. So now I mix two things. I say this would be the final end. It would be this free energy, which defines what you get. And if you prepare your initial state here, it turns out that here is fx and fy, i.e. this vector in xy plane. It's zero at the beginning. So you put the state or the system at the unstable fixed point of this potential. Good. That would be the equivalent of what we do here. And one has to remember this is a picture on two different limits, initial state and maybe final state thermodynamically. Okay, so now we can do this experiment. And since we can measure fx and fy, we can look at what happens over time with this kind of spin in x and y direction. What you see here is the probability to detect a certain direction of the spin. And you see nicely after 42 seconds, you find out that the system has settled down to this ring, which you would expect in thermal equilibrium to happen. Okay, and you have also the instability at the beginning explodes like massively fast because that's about 1 second. Okay, so now this is nice somehow, but it does not tell you about what I told you before. The structure which develops in time changes. And here it seems like the ring is there and that's it. But we have more information. We have more information because we measure the experiment, we detect the experiment, the situation spatially resolved. So each realization we do has a certain trajectory. If you go from left to right, wherever the endpoint is here, you have a certain trajectory on this fxy plane. So these kind of fluctuations here boil down to you never go to here for this situation, but you're fluctuating around this circle. Okay? Yeah?
42 seconds.
Yes.
It's a bit, these are your experiments.
Yes.
For so long.
Yes. That's now a speciality of my group. Yeah, there's actually, yeah, we can talk about this, but this is true for kind of these dynamics and not decaying and seeing the things, this time scale is special for our experiment. Anyway, so we do this, we then look at the correlation function and remember what we expect. We would expect that this correlation function, now in momentum space, structure factor should develop self-similar in time, i.e. the function does not change. But it doesn't change in time. All you have to do is you have to rescale the k value, i.e. the length scale, and the amplitude. And that's what comes out. Jörg did the same experiment with another system, not the same experiment. He did a thermal quench in one-dimensional situation. He got different exponents out of one and one. And Soran did very nice work recently and also in the last years, where he also looked into this kind of question, does the time dynamics get simple in such a way that it can describe by a function and two parameters, exponents. Okay, so this is actually interesting because now you find something nobody predicted. Almost was predicted in the O(n) model, n to infinity, there is a phenomenon where this should happen. Okay? And that's the nice thing about if it's universal, that's okay. Okay? That's exactly what you want. It doesn't depend on the detail of the system. It has to have certain ingredients to get there. And one ingredient here, what's important, is the occupation numbers are large. That's a weakly interacting system, but you have high occupation number. What matters is interaction times occupation number, what defines what's going on. Okay, so with that, I wanted to do this interlude inception now. So this is a theory. There are these objects which actually connect four fields with each other. And the question is, can one tackle this experimentally? And one has to say on this form, no. But if you go to an equal time formulation, you can read out something like this one particle irreducible four vertex by looking for four-point correlation, two-point correlation, do the proper analysis in order to kind of get something out like this gamma four, which is appearing here. And this gamma four here is depending on time, so you have to do it for different times, you have to show what happens, and actually we find also that this four vertices also scale in time, as also expected from the theory. And expected from the theory is always like a little bit wrong, because the theory is not our system. It's a theory in the O(n) model. Anyway, this is something I want to put there, that maybe this is a way of going the opposite way. The simulator gives you the quantum effective action of the system. So that's an answer the simulator gives us. Okay, so now Inception. Who knows the movie Inception? Yeah, then you know it's about seeds. You set a seed and it will grow. Positively, hopefully. Okay, anyway, so when you look in this kind of history of the universe picture, we discussed now how can article gases tackle somehow some questions which are in the context of producing these kind of situations in the lab at CERN. This was about this time scale. And if you look at this picture, I don't know here in this audience if you resonate with this picture very much, because it's kind of a particle-orientated picture. And I think much more kind of attractive is this picture, at least if you look at it, how it's drawn. And something is added here. It's here you see the constituents performing what's in the volume somehow or in space. Here, somehow, it seems that there is a space volume. And that cost me a long time to somehow understand that this is not the volume you're plotting here with this bottle. You're plotting the metric. You're plotting that space expands, and it's not like a bubble which expands, the whole space expands. And if this is wrong, please let me know afterwards. Okay, so if this is the equation, and it looks so innocent, and all of you know much better, it's not innocent, it's a horrible equation, or an interesting equation which is hard to solve, and this is not what we can do. There's no way at the moment, and I think in principle not. But we can take this equation and ask, or at least I can ask, what are the elements in there? And one element is the metric. Okay. So this equation gives me how the metric will evolve with all these kind of back actions included, and it's very complicated to solve. But at the end, what the theory gives me is this G mu nu. Okay, so now if I can generate G mu nus, which are kind of inspired by the theoretical description, I can ask the next question. Given I have a scalar field on top of this metric, what happens if I change the metric in the way which is predicted by this kind of equation? And prediction by this equation is limited, as far as I understand. You have to make certain assumption. And the cosmological assumption here is homogeneity and the isotropy, which helps to reduce the potential possible matrix massively, and you get down to the FLLW matrix, which I write down here as an experimentalist in two dimensions plus one, because our experiments will be in two dimensions. And three dimensions for me anyway, too complicated. In two dimensions, I can a little bit think, so to speak. Okay, so this metric here has, funny enough, only two parameters. It has curvature and it has scale factor. That's somehow cool, because if I get this connection between time and space of this form, and experimentally can address kappa as well as A, oh, I can do something, because that's the only parameters in this kind of limit, is the only thing what's there. Okay, can we do this? Can we change kappa and can we change A? So what do we have? We have the metric, and the metric is actually not kind of spatially limited. It's given connection everywhere. If independent of where I am, it should be homogeneous, i.e. it doesn't matter where I am, it should be this one. Okay, so now I can draw this even, because it's a hyperbolic plane, and if you think about geodesic connections between this and that point, you get this line, which is actually ds squared 0, solving this kind of equation with negative kappa. Okay, so a two dimension, hyperbolic plane, infinite extended, is 10 minutes, thank you, is given by this metric. Or if you move on this on the surface, you would follow this metric. Ask about circumferences or angles, it's given by that. And that's experimentally extremely disappointing somehow, because infinite space is hard to hardly available. We get some lab space, but not infinite. Now the question is, can we resolve this somehow and get infinite space on finite space? And there is a way of doing it for this very peculiar curvature, namely you can do a Poincaré's construction, where actually you map these points onto a finite-sized disk, and you find out that all the points here on this surface map onto a finite disk map. Sounds like a cool thing, kind of compressing infinite space in finite space, but it's not, right? Because what changes is, well, here the ruler, and let me define the ruler as speed of light, and we will talk about sound, so speed of sound times proper time gives me a length scale, it's a ruler, it's a physical ruler. But here the ruler is everywhere the same on this curved space. In the map, the ruler is not constant in space. The ruler changes as you go out to the edge, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. In the limit of the rim, it's infinitely small. That means the circumference of this circle is infinitely long. Okay, and the metric given in this situation then is magically given, or magically maybe not, but it's given by this kind of expression. It's just a brief factor. The scale factor depends now on space. And there we have just a connection between r and phi. So if we are able to adjust our natural ruler in space and in time, we are happy, because then we have the two parameters, curvature as well as scale factor. So can we do this? Well, before we do this, we kind of enjoy Escher hyperbolic geometry, because that's exactly what he uses in order to fill a finite circle with these kind of whatever animals these are, sometimes angels and devils, but this is another one. So it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and this is actually what hyperbolic geometry is about. Okay, so now what do we have at hand? What we have at hand is an experiment on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, an observation. The observation here is you measure how many particles are at a certain position. And remember, we do it also in voxels, so we ask how many particles on average are on a certain distance, a certain volume. Then you get this kind of answer if you do this in a harmonic trap, that most particles are in the middle and few particles are at the edge. Okay, finite size. And Bill yesterday said he wants a plate. Here's a plate. And this plate actually is not small, but it's like 40x meters wide. Now, 40x meters has a small print, and the small print says this x equals to mu. So it's 40 micrometers, as he said yesterday. It's too small, okay? But what I will show you is that actually this finite size is exactly what we need in order to generate curvature. Okay, so here's the plate, and what we are going to do now with this plate is we excite excitations on top of the plate, phonons, and since a plate is too stiff, we go back to the gas and have a gas. We have phononic excitations on top of the gas, and then we are going to do the physics on this phononic field. The phononic field is a composite field of the fundamental fields of the particles. A phonon is a collective motion of many particles. Okay? That's the limit we are going for. Okay, so now we can ask about rulers. Rulers are how far does light get in 1 nanosecond? It's 1 foot. Here is the question in a proper time, certain time given, how far does a depletion, i.e. a coherent superposition of phonons, propagate in time, and we spread out. Bit of sound. If you do the same thing at the edge, well, it also spreads out, but it looks different, because the sound velocity is lower, because sound velocity depends on density. High density, fast, low density, slow. Okay, and so now if you plot now Escher on top of it, you find out, oh, this matches. It's the two eyes of these things are given by this kind of circle. Okay, so it seems like, naively, from this one, you cannot choose. You just know the magic depends on space, distance depends on space. If it's hyperbolic or not, you don't know, right? You have to show that these kind of velocities here are going the proper way, namely with 1 minus r squared, the whole thing squared. Okay, so now this is done, has been done by Stefan Flöchinger, and he started with mathematically describing the situation with a classical field plus fluctuations on top, which are the phonons. You take the imaginary part of this complex field of excitations, and then you run the machinery, and what you find is that this kind of complex, so this complex part of the phononic field is a real field, and this real field fulfills this action. And this action just says, but actually, there's a geomu of the form we were hoping for, namely hyperbolic, in good approximation, and you have a scalar field, which is the phonons themselves, which form this field. Actually, the imaginary part for this formula. The nice thing is that phi 1 is phi dot. Okay? They are conjugate fields too. Okay, so this is now what we have. We have phononic fields should live on a metric, i.e. on space, and all we can do is, there is no mass, there is no interaction of this field, relatively boring, but what we can do is, we can change the metric. And we cannot change it via doing running dynamics, we can change it actively. Okay, so now what can you do? The first thing, if you have curved space, you do the original experiment, take a sun eclipse, look at the stars, and you see the stars you would not see because they're behind the sun, so you look at curved propagations. So this is easily done, you just plug in here a hole, that's easily done by just shining a laser in, let it propagate, and what you see is it spreads out, and if you analyze it properly, it spreads out exactly as expected from the metric. So how much time? 4 minutes. And I have to go faster. If you have a simulator, you would like to be able to change things, right? If I have only negative kappa, it's one thing, but what about positive kappa? A positive kappa would be a sphere, and if you look at the mapping here of the sphere to this finite disk, or half sphere, then what you see is actually all what changes, the ruler gets larger as you go to the edge. While here, the ruler gets smaller to the edge. And all what I've told you is, you should know the answer, or you know the answer most likely. All you need is a bizarre density distribution, namely it's maximum at the border and it's minimal and non-zero in the middle. And if you do this kind of curved space, which is now positively curved, this wave-back propagation in the map looks very different, obviously different, and you can compare it with the theory if it does what you expect from the geodesics and you get reasonably happy. Now that's what it looks like. Now, what was this now? It's a quantum gas. You let a wave packet expand of phonons and see space is curved. Is this quantum? No, it's not quantum. It's the most classical thing you can do. You throw in a coherent state and ask, what does a coherent state do? So where is quantum here? I said quantum field simulator. Actually, quantum enters very naturally if you don't think about kappa, but if you think about scale factor time dependent. Because scale factor time dependent, if you rip space apart, and you have a scalar field living on this space, you will get excitation on this field. And can we do this too? Okay, so now we know, I mean, you know much better than me, if you have this metric, you get equations for the scale factor, you get solutions, and the funny thing here is two dimension, so the meta-dominated regime is linear in T, and the meta-dominated in 3D is in our case radiation dominated in 2D, so with exponent 2/3. Okay, so now what we do is we don't have meta-dominated nor radiation-dominated. We have an exponent in the time scale factor. So all we have to do now is we dial in the scale factor and do it with different power laws and see how the scalar field reacts to these kind of changes. Okay, so now that means we don't take this left picture. We expand space or really let the system expand. What we do is we take the system constant. Nothing is moving. And that's an important thing, nothing is moving, but we change the ruler in time. So expansion is equivalent to making the ruler smaller. ruler is given by the sound velocity, i.e. all we have to make is sound velocity smaller. We can decrease the sound velocity because we don't have a plate where the sound speed, the speed of sound is given because of the crystal or whatever this is, ceramics. We have a gas, and the fluffiness of the gas depends on how the particle interacts. And that we can control. We can make it weakly interacting or strongly interacting, and with that we can decrease or adjust the stiffness of the gas. I.e. we can change the ruler if we want to change it. All you have to do is, if you have a power law, you have to change 1 over the power law squared, the scattering length, which is a number which defines how well things are oscillating, interacting. So I see time is over. At the end of the day, it looks like this. Before expansion, this is the initial state. You produce, you have fluctuations. If you do the expansion, then you see the fluctuations are there. They are much larger, and they have a certain length scale. Good thing about this, you can repeat it. You do it again and again and again, and then with that get precision measurements or precision estimation of correlation function in the system, which is then what you are interested in. So now I have to go faster. So this is actually the result of, if you see these fluctuations there, you say, oh, super cool, I've seen particle production, it's fluctuations. And turns out it's much better to do the experiment, you produce it, and then you keep the universe constant, not expanding. There's no problem for us, it's not dynamical, we can just stop it and wait. And if you wait, what we get is Sakharov oscillations. The initial fluctuations translate into oscillations in momentum space as function, in momentum space as function of time, and we can extract from that the amplitude as well as the phase, and the structure factor has this impute. It has, depends on a phase and an amplitude. The phase is typically not what you have, and the first iteration with theory was there is no oscillation because typically do a random phase approximation, which is not true in our case because we can look at this, this interference phenomenon as a function of time. Okay, so what we do is we measure Sakharov oscillations for getting an estimate of particle production, and that's what you get out. And the cool thing is not that you get an amplitude out. The cool thing is that the phase shows you directly history. Not directly, but it depends critically on the history. And the linear expansion, remember this was the meta-dominated regime in 2D, has a peculiar feature, namely it has a phase jump. And this phase jump is connected to a zero of scattering. It's connected to Ramsauer-Towns phenomenon in atomic physics. It's understandable. We can do with bounces and whatever, yeah, barometric resonance is first time. And with that, I stop here. I would like to thank the team working on this experiment, this experimental team. This is a theory team. Stefan Flöchinger kind of initiated everything theoretically, and the exchange was extremely fruitful and interesting. I didn't talk about condensation and thermalization as well as entanglement detection in quantum field settings, but I told you a little bit about how you can do curved space-time dynamics as a scalar field. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcus, for the interesting talk, and I particularly enjoyed the ambitious movie references there. Very inspiring. Any questions?
Oh, sorry, I was a little bit long.
We can go here first.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Yeah, very interesting. I'm just, so if I understood it correctly, the imaginary part of the fluctuations in the BEC behaves like a scalar on a background of constant negative curvature. Is that right?
Depends on the density distribution, if it's negative, positive, or flat.
Okay, my question is, what's the intuition behind it? Like, what is it about a BEC that ultimately leads to that result?
It's actually that the BEC has an excitation spectrum. The excitations are linear, and for higher momentum, smaller scale, it gets quadratic. But the linear part is what makes it. So you have a relativistic part at low k, so I mean like long wavelengths, and that's what it makes. And what you have is the control of the speed of sound, of these modes, so to speak, which are linear in k. That makes the metric possible.
Okay.
The metric generally is always possible, right? The question is just, does it map to FLRW or not? Because it's a connection between, yeah. Okay, the equation gets so simple, maybe I repeat, comes from the fact that the excitations are simple for a condensate in long wavelength limit. I hope this was an answer.
Okay, so I have a question about the first part of the talk, about the self-similar dynamics of the quench. If I understood right, like different setups, they give different critical exponents. The critical exponents, alpha and beta, that you measured, they were different. You measured, but then there were other experiments that measured different values.
Yes.
So is there any universality classes here? Can you kind of... Yeah, first question, actually, the exponents you measured, were they the same as predicted by OIN model or not? And if not, then can you kind of identify universality classes where your experiment would kind of match?
Yeah, experiment is very hard to show that you can classify universality classes, but you can do many different experiments and find out many of them fall, the exponents are the same, and then you might hope that this is a universality class, right? It's a theoretical question, the universality classes.
Right.
And I know Jürgen tells me, there might be something there, but one has to find and sort out how do you classify them.
Mm-hmm.
And what enters is, but one thing, like Soren did nice experiments on that. For example, it depends on the underlying kind of structure of your system, for example, different critical exponent due to the fact that you have different kind of second order phase transitions with different exponents, they might show up in this kind of dynamics. For example, that would be a way of sorting it. But there is also this kind of phenomenon without any critical point. You don't need a critical, it's just our case is a trick. But we don't have to use this. We can just throw in whatever we like in high excitation and we would get the same thing. So the short answer is there might be, but it's not yet classified as far as I know, that I have model A, model B, model D, model D. I think it's not yet there.
And the OIN model has different critical exponents from what you measured, or?
Yes, it can have different, it can have you know, it's very, you ask a general question, I cannot answer it general, I can ask different systems have different exponents.
Okay.
Depending on the initial state, for example, you can have
that.
Get the different exponents, and not
I
only
see.
After Hamiltonian, then you change the Hamiltonian structure, will also enter in these exponents. So they're exactly at the moment different ingredients, and one has to sort out what is it.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling is it's not only the Hamiltonian which enters, it's also the initial condition what enters. Because the redistribution of the thing depends on what you have macroscopically occupied. And this depends also on the initial state. And how to characterize that, I'm very happy to find out what would be an idea to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
If we can have the next speaker coming down to set up, we've got maybe one room for one more quick question.
Take Cisco.
Sorry, I was just curious about the particle production in this scenario, because you have this stereographic projection between the infinite and the finite spaces. Is this a time-dependent transformation?
No.
Okay. So the particle. I was just curious because the particle production just caused by a changing metric. It might not match the actual cosmological particle production if there's
okay,
any time.
Okay. Maybe we should do two things. One thing is that particle production is in a limit here where space is flat. The curvature on the particle production was negligibly small. There is some influence, but it's small. Okay? So now the other thing is the mapping is given, but what you change is the ruler, the distances you can change. So the system is fixed in space. There's nothing moving. All you do is you change the interaction with that the ruler. Is that maybe?
Yeah. So particle production by change time-varying metric, right?
Yeah, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we have time for one more question. This is a very quick one. Why don't you mimic exponential growth?
Why do I?
It's a scale factor. It's polynomial.
Yeah,
why not exponential?
Exponential is, if you want to see exponential behavior and some e-fold, say, you would like to be able to double your system and not only once or twice, but you want to double it 100 times. And there is, at the moment...
That's not true. Four e-fold.
Okay.
Not true.
Then they say there's a number.
It's not 100.
So let me formulate it differently. An exponential is
the
sum of infinitely many polynomials, x squared, x to the 3, x to the 4, and so on. If you do each individual one, you might also get information about what an exponential will do.
But But is there a technical challenge? Is it a technical reason why you haven't tested it? Is it just you're not interested, or?
Actually, I had to learn that actually the power law dependence of the excitations or of the fluctuations in the universe have a 0.96 or 7 power law, and that's an interesting question. Is this coming from the finite time of the inflation? Okay, that I learned recently. And the other thing is, no, I cannot do 70 E folds versus 80 E folds, because that would mean 2 to the power 80 is impossible. I don't have to start. And that's why we stick to the things where we think we can be safe in a regime where we can compare with theoretical expectations. That's why we didn't do it.
So I just meant like the exponential change, not the duration of the whole.
Yeah, but this belongs together. If you change it faster than the collision rate, then you have to give up all this description. They may have to collide in order to form this collective field you are dealing with. You can't do it infinitely fast. It doesn't help you. And that's why you're limited.
When everyone starts getting hungry, you can blame Silke, not me. Let's thank Marcus again for a great talk.